This is episode 464 of Wheel Bearings. I am Sam of Will Samid from Telemetry.
And I am Roberto Baldwin from SAE International.
And we still don't have our third yet for this week. Hopefully next week we will have a third host joining us. But in the meantime, what'd you drive this week, Robbie?
Well, for the dudes episode, I drove the 2025, even though it is now 2026, the 2025 BMW M5 Touring.
So just a regular family car, station wagon.
It is a station wagon. It is for, you know, taking the family around town, doing grocery shopping, hitting up the hardware store, you know, all the usual, going on long trips.
Stuff a bale or two of straw in the back of it.
Yeah, heading to Wally World. And it also is equipped with a V8 engine, and it's a plug-in hybrid, and it is an M for magnificent. I think... What's funny is when I became an automotive journalist, someone asked me what kind of car I like, and I responded, I'm like, well, you know, I like fast wagons. And they're like, well, of course you are. You're a car journalist. And I didn't realize that was a thing, which meant that I'd always been a car journalist.
you were always a car journalist at heart.
Yes.
You were meant to be one.
I was meant to be an automotive journalist. The M5 Touring, if you're not aware, is a station wagon that is very, very, very fast. It has, wait for it, an ungodly amount of horsepower, 717 horsepower, 738 pound-feet of torque. That is from a V8, two motors, an electric motor, and a V8, not a V6, a V8.
With
twin turbos. It's like the Mary Kate and Ashley of turbos. Twin turbos coming together, twin squirrel turbochargers. It is very fast. It is very fun, and it is very utilitarian. I could I did a little bit of shopping with it while I had it, because of course I did. I cruised around town. I did, and it is a plug-in hybrid, which for a plug-in hybrid, this is a bonkers machine, but it is a plug-in hybrid. It has 25 miles of range. I unfortunately did not have a chance to do my range run because I was too busy having fun. So let's just say yes. Every time I went out, yes, it has electric range. Yes, you can plug it in at home. Yes, if you live 13 miles from work, or 12.5 miles from work, you can get there and back maybe without the engine firing up. But you're probably going to make the engine fire up because you are driving an M5. That said, it is very tight. It is very low. It is very planted to the road, even though it is a very chunky vehicle. It is a pretty, it's got a V8, so it's a wagon, heavy, a V8, heavy, an extra motor, the electric motor, heavy, and kilowatts? 14.8 kilowatt hour battery pack. So now it's some more heavy. And all that weight means it is a chunky vehicle, but it is, over 700 horsepower, over 700 pound-feet of torque. It definitely can get out of its way and out of everyone else's way. And that low-end hybrid system does really, for the low-end, the hybrid system really does kind of help get you up and going, while, internal combustion engines, they still got to spin up and get ready, and turbo, there's turbo lag. And so making this a plug-in hybrid, actually really smart, to be honest, because you're getting that additional little bit of performance. Plus, and again, you got 25 miles of just electric range. You could just cruise around town with the motor off, just nice and quiet, and just having a nice time, except for the stance of the vehicle. It's very low. It is very, it is planted. Other than that, I think the average person is just like, oh, this guy went out and bought a BMW station wagon. Isn't he a thoughtful and considerate and very smart man who really cares about being able to deliver soccer goods to a field or picking up, you know, hundreds of $5 chickens from Costco? How very considerate of him and society, but instead, a very fast car. It is a very fun vehicle to drive. It's a very fun vehicle to have. I wore my station wagon T-shirt today in honor of the M5 Touring. I very much enjoyed this vehicle. The only thing that could make it better is if it was a manual transmission. I mean, what are you going to do about that? No one's going to give you a manual transmission. It's got paddle shifters, but it's never going to be the same as a manual transmission. Yeah, the manuals are all gone, which is sad face. Boop. Oh, yeah. So you got fake, So you're not going to, you know, if you still want a manual, you got to get, one of the $30,000-ish enthusiast cars out there. You're not going to get that in anything that has a lot of power. That said, everything about this car, really fun, but also the price. Not so much fun. Starting price, $121,500. It is not. You're paying for a lot of money for, the V8, and the, everything about this vehicle. I will say that, the brakes on this thing are fantastic. I love great brakes, and the brakes on this car are just like chef's kiss. Amazing. Is it $121,500? Amazing. I guess. Sure. I don't have that kind of money. So it's just, at some point you kind of have to, like, everything doesn't matter anymore. It's all in a world of fantasy where you can afford a vehicle like this and you're someone like me. It doesn't help that it had a carbon ceramic brakes, which were an $8,500 option. Yeah, I know. Dare to dream. Well, that's, you know, before all the things. There's also a $2,600 gas guzzler tax on this vehicle, even though it is a plug-in hybrid and it has 25, you know, it has 54 MPGE, you know, that weird made-up thing. But regular gasoline only, 13 miles per gallon. Which, again, makes sense. It's a twin turbo V8. I mean, what are you going to do? It's, you know, it's a high performance twin turbo V8. No, it is a chunky vehicle. You know what? Let me find out how much it weighs. Curb weight, brakes, steering. Uh-oh, maybe they don't have it. Anyway, it does 0 to 60 in an estimated 3.5 seconds, which is something that, you know, I can't really, you know, where am I going to test that at my house? Okay, here we go. So the curb weight preliminary estimate, this is from the press release back in 2024 when they first announced this vehicle, 5,530 pounds, which is it's not a Hummer, but it's not a light vehicle. Again, a V8. A battery pack, a long wheelbase, a long car. That all said, if you are rich and you're looking for a performance car, why wouldn't you buy this? It's, you know, I need, it's bright red. It is one of those cars that the people who know it. I take a lot of my cars to band practice. And then there are some cars I just don't. I take my own car because the people that know what this car is. And I feel like people that know, it's like the Type R. It's just the way. Yeah, but it's like the Type R situation when I had the Civic Type R and the wheels got stolen off of it. And I had taken, oh, you're gone again. That's very weird. It's like the Type R situation where when I had the Civic Type R, I would park it in garages. I wouldn't leave it on the street. And the time I did leave it on the street, someone stole all the wheels. So, yeah. So it's one of those vehicles where the people know. And some of those people are young dudes who are just like, dude, let's. Yeah. You can't trust young dudes is what I'm trying to tell you.
No, definitely not.
You can't trust the young dudes. It has a track mode. Which is fun for a station wagon. When it has the two M buttons on the steering wheel, M1 mm-hmm. is regular, sort of like the M sport mode. M2, it's like gives you all the warnings and makes you press it again. It's like, hey, we're going to turn off stability control. We're going to turn this off. We're going to turn that off. We're going to turn all these things off. So if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to wreck your car.
Yeah.
That said, it is a, it is a very fun car to drive. It is a fun car to, it is utilitarian. I think it is an important car out in the world because it shows the world if this thing is selling well. I'm not really sure. I forgot to look it up. If this thing is selling well, you know, maybe we'll get more. I mean, Volvo says they're bringing wagons back.
Yeah.
Well, fingers crossed that people start realizing that wagons are pretty dope. That all said, with everything, I guess it's weird to have you guess the destination, Charlie, but I'll make you do it anyway.
$1,275.
Oh, which for a car that costs, you know, almost as much as a house in some parts of the world. The total cost of the vehicle I was driving was $145,775,
which is. And that was including you said $8,000 for the carbon ceramic brakes.
$8,500 for the carbon ceramic brakes. And then it has a $2,500 driver's package, M driver's package, which. Sure. I just add some more stuff. I will say that the seats are there is a spot in the seat that is a little too hard for my back. It's in a weird spot. Maybe the seat has been worn out from people using it. I don't know. Not a fan of these particular seats just because there's some weird spot that just stabs me in the back. And I feel like this is going to be more and more of an issue as I get older. Were things that I would be fine with before. I'm like, this is kind of, I don't know about this. What if I have to drive, you know, 500 miles in this? I at the end of the day, when people are like, oh, I'm concerned about range. I'm concerned about, I'm fine. Whatever. You can be concerned about range. I'm more concerned about how I feel after an hour and a half to, you know, 2 hours in a seat. Am I going to be like getting out of the car all twisted like a pretzel, or am I going to get out of the car and be able to like walk up and buy some beef jerky and, you know, either refuel or, you know, recharge and then get on my way? That's my big issue with any sort of range stuff. So, yeah, that was the BMW M5 Touring. It's fantastic, but also very expensive. It's fantastically expensive.
Oh. Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, t-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. All right, so I've moved up to my actual office. Instead of my virtual
office.
Where
are you usually?
Down in the basement, where I have a green screen and a picture of my office.
Ah. Clearly, this is just my filth. There's my jacket sleeve. There's my tape decks. There's some tapes. There's a Devo hat. There's a Pirelli hat from an F1 race. There's a Walkman. And there's a, a pinata. Plus, one of the first... Daft Punk helmets, which has since collapsed because we used to make them out of paper mache. What's on top of it? Oh, there's a cat head on top of that. Which, if ever we need me to be in a cat, wear a cat head during a podcast, I'm good to go. Or a monster head, or one of the 50 other Daft Punk helmets I have lying around in my garage, which are taking too much space, to be honest.
You got too many Daft Punk helmets. All right. All right, I'm just getting the Monroney open for the car that I had. All right, let's continue. I'm back.
Welcome back.
All right, so anything else on the M5 Touring?
No, it's fun. It's a wagon. It's too much money for me, but if you're rich and you want kind of a sleeper, go for it.
All right. Well, I also had a car, a vehicle that was too much money and is too fast to make any kind of sense whatsoever. I had the Rivian R1T Quad Max. This is the original Rivian, the R1T, but it's the latest version of it. So this is the second generation R1T that they refreshed a couple of years ago. And this time, you can get it with two motors, three motors, or four motors. So I had one that has four motors, which means that it has 1,025 horsepower, which is just, it's bonkers.
It's like, why?
Exactly.
It's a
my
truck.
Sentiments. Exactly. Yeah.
It's a truck.
It is. Okay. It's a slightly larger than mid-sized pickup truck. The R1T Quad starts at $115,990. And this one had two options on it: the storm blue paint for $3,000 and the slate sky and walnut wood interior, which is actually really quite lovely. So you get this, kind of gray leather covering the seats, and there's this walnut veneer trim inside. Unlike Teslas, like they used to refer to the Tesla Model S and the Model X as luxury cars. But that was based purely on their price, relative to actual luxury cars like Mercedes-Benz or BMW. They were never actually very luxurious. The R1s are actually surprisingly premium feeling on the inside. And it's overall, it's quite a nice interior, at least to look at and to feel. But I have some issues with it. First, there's the obvious one, which I'm not going to beat that dead horse to death today, which is, the software-defined vents. Dumb idea. Stop doing it, please. End of story. But because I know they're not going to stop. They've made it pretty clear they have no intention of stopping.
I mean, everyone says they're not going to do something, but if it's hurting sales, right now it's not, to be honest. I mean, there's still very much the Patagonia of EVs, the Patagonia of cars, and the people are going to buy it, and they're going to just ignore the fact that they have to do stuff. But at some point, when you hit like a mass adoption, when regular people are like, "What's going on?" That's when they're like, "You know what? Let's just put some little."
My other main complaint about the interior of the R1 is the seats. The seats are actually not very comfortable. They're not kind of lumpy feeling. And I just could not get a comfortable position in them at all. The other day I went out to dinner with my wife and she was sitting in there and said, she really didn't like the seats either. Not good seats. Fortunately, the R2 has completely different seats. These seats were designed by a supplier. The R2 has seats that were designed and built in-house by Rivian. In the short time I had with the R2, they seemed better, but we'll find out, hopefully soon when I get one for a week-long review. But the seats in the R1 just not very good. But the main reason I asked to get into this R1 was because I've been hoping to try out Rivian's Universal Hands-Free Driving, which is the latest edition of their ADAS system. They announced this back in December when they had their AI and Autonomy Day out in Palo Alto. And when what they're doing, when they first launched the R1, they had hands-on lane centering assist, worked on highways, sorta, kinda. But in starting what they announced in December and what they started rolling out earlier this year was what they're calling Universal Hands-Free, which is basically it will allow hands-free capability on any road in North America that has lane markings. And as it turns out, even some roads that don't have lane markings. So it's not a full, the industry has come to call some of these systems, you've got level two, which is what SAE defines, which just means that it controls steering and speed together as part of one system. And level two is kind of a broad spectrum of stuff. So it goes everything from, hands-on, eyes-on systems like Nissan ProPilot Assist, the version one, up to what much of the industry is calling level 2++, which is hands-on, hands-off, eyes-on. Full lane, hands-off lane centering, but you still have to watch the road. But it recognizes traffic signals and basically gives you point-to-point. You can put in a destination and your navigation and the vehicle will drive under your supervision to that destination. And that's what Tesla's FSD is more or less, and the new system on the Mercedes CLA that's powered by NVIDIA, those are level 2++ systems. This is, and then level 2+ is the hands-off, eyes-on systems that are limited to certain roads, but it doesn't recognize traffic signals, so it won't stop for stop signs or red lights, things like that. Won't make turns. That's what GM Super Cruise, Ford's Blue Cruise. And then this is kind of a step beyond that, where it still doesn't recognize the traffic signals, but it works on 3.5 million miles of roads in North America. So basically any road in North America, you can use it. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, not entirely convinced it's a good
thing. You can use it, doesn't mean it's good.
Yeah. I mean, for what it is purported to be, it actually works pretty well. It works a lot better than the system that Stellantis has on the Ram pickups and on the Grand Cherokee, which still doesn't do a great job of actually keeping the vehicle centered in the lane. You know, when you're going around corners, it kind of drifts towards the outside of the corner. Not ideal. This actually does a pretty good job of control in the lane. And for things like, when you're going down a highway, you come up to a place where, okay, this lane is ending, need to move over. It will, in fact, move over into the next lane, although it doesn't do it until, you get to the end of the lane. So if you're in some traffic, you better move over on your own, because what it's doing is it's following the lane marker, on the outside of the lane that is disappearing. And when that lane disappears, it'll keep the distance to that away from that lane marking and just merge over into the adjacent lane. So I was actually out trying this out earlier this morning, a section of road out here on I-94. Fortunately there was not traffic where it was doing that. But it will merge over, which, most other systems still won't do. Most other systems will tell you, put your hands back on the wheel, merge over, if they do anything at all. So there's that. It has lane change on demand. So if you tap the turn signal, it will check. And Rivian is using, I think, 11 or 12 cameras on here, high-resolution cameras. Most of them are 8-megapixel cameras. They've got 5 radars, including an imaging radar on the front, and then 4 corner radars. So it's got a lot more sensing than a Tesla does, but it's still, it's not something, you know, when they get to going, the next generation system that's coming on the R2, end of this year, early next year, is adding LiDAR to it. And that's the system that they hope to eventually grow to being level 3 or level 4 capable. So this system, it will do lane change on demand when you put on the turn signal. And it's actually fairly conservative. So it does a pretty good job of making sure that there's a real gap there, you know, and it looks, you know, if there's a car coming up in the adjacent lane at a fairly decent closing rate, it will wait before it tries to step over. So it was good at that stuff. I think they took a fairly safe, conservative approach to that. So that's good. Overall, you know, the system performs reasonably well. Going through my neighborhood here, I live in a residential neighborhood where there are no lane markings. Although, like going down the middle of the road, the side street, where there's a seam in the asphalt that's been sealed, it will recognize that seam as a lane marking, and it will stay to one side, and it'll follow that. So even, you know, at 20, 25 miles an hour through the neighborhood, it will go hands-free. I do not recommend doing that, because, you know, there's people around. You should not be doing that. You know, should probably not be using this really anywhere in cities, but that's, you know, that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But, you know, for most of what it's designed to do, you know, I think it does a pretty good job. It didn't try to do anything dumb. It was good at recognizing cut-ins, you know, so if somebody was merging into your lane, you know, it would back off a little bit. It was good at doing speed adjustments on tighter corners to be able to get around the corner safely. So there's a couple of spots around here where, until relatively recently, Blue Cruise would always just give up and say, "Put your hands back on the wheel." It handled those situations just fine. The latest version of Rivian software, they do their own software stack, but they're using Google Maps. But they haven't, they're not doing anything like what GM does now with Super Cruise, where, if you're using the navigation, Super Cruise will, if you have an exit coming up, Super Cruise will automatically move you over into the appropriate lane for your exit as you're approaching it. So as you're, a mile, 3/4 of a mile from your exit, it'll try and make sure you're in the correct lane, so you don't have to jump over 3 lanes. This doesn't attempt to do that at all. So it doesn't attempt to do any kind of automatic lane changing on its own without you initiating it. That's something that Rivian has said should be coming later this year, towards the end of the year, the full level 2++, where it recognizes the traffic signals. What it does do, even though it doesn't respond to the traffic signals, it does pop up on the instrument cluster and saying, "Hey, there's a traffic signal, pay attention." So just to give you a little alert, that there's, you may need to hit the brakes. It's, for what it is, it's a pretty good system. I think Rivian's done a pretty decent job with it, but I'm still dubious about these systems in general.
It's almost like a, hey, look, we can do sort of situation with these systems is where we're at with these. Some are obviously better than others. It's very much like, hey, look, this thing we can do. But at the end of the day, you're still in charge. So if I'm still in charge, like, I should just keep my hands on the wheel.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because if the robot gets confused, like, it's not the robot's fault. It's my fault. So if the robot gets confused and runs into another car, runs into a median, runs into an emergency vehicle, I can say, well, the robot got confused, and that doesn't mean anything, because it's ultimately ultimately, it is my responsibility of what the vehicle is doing. And if it's my responsibility, yeah, I'm just going to probably keep my hands on the wheel.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a, hey, this is great. The cars are smarter. They can do these things, but they're not smart enough. It's like, you know, it's like, hey, your toddler could, like, you know, climb something that seems dangerous, but you're standing right behind the toddler, like with your hands hovering over them the whole time. Like, oh, look what it's doing. Because if a toddler falls, you are the person who is watching the toddler.
Yeah.
So,
let's see what else. As I said, the one I had was a Quad Max. So it's got the big battery. It's about 135, 140 kilowatt hour battery pack. The Quad is available with three different wheel and tire combinations. There's two 22-inch wheel combinations, one with high-performance tires and one with ultra-high-performance tires. And then there is a 20-inch wheel with all-terrain tires. So basically, you can get a 22-inch with summer performance tires, a 22-inch with more all-season type tires, and then 20-inch with all-terrains. The one that I had was had the all-terrains, which means that it has the lowest range of the three quad variants. So the all-season tires, it's rated at 374 miles of range on a charge. The high-performance tires version is rated at 338 miles. And the all-terrains are rated at 325 miles of range. In the week of driving this thing, I used about 50%. When I got to 50% of the battery capacity, I had gone 151 miles. So roughly 300-ish miles is what you can expect with the Quad with the all-terrain tires. I did not do any off-road stuff with this. I did not try the tank turn feature. I couldn't find a suitable spot to do that. And, you know, again, it's one of those goofy gimmicks. The other thing is with the all, depending on which set of tires you have on there, the traction control will also limit the acceleration capability. So if you get the high performance summer tires, it will, and you put it in sport mode, it will do roughly 2.5 seconds 0 to 60. When I went out and tried this. Plugged in and took my race box out there. I got about 3.7 seconds, 0 to 60, which is just, again, for a pickup truck, it's just, it's ridiculous. Nobody needs to go that fast in a truck. On the plus side, compared to like the Chevy Silverado EV and the Hummer, which, you know, I don't know if you've tried doing, you know, full-on acceleration runs with either of those, but they have some nasty vehicle dynamics. They tend to wander all over the place. You get a lot of torque steer from it, and it's kind of wandering around the road as it's going down the road when you do full-on acceleration. The Rivian, straight, smooth, and straight. No problem at all. So much better driving dynamics when you're accelerating.
I mean, it's and better, then, but also it's a big vehicle. Doesn't need to be going that fast. There's a lot of mass.
Yeah, exactly.
Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Yes. So my recommendation is if you want to buy an R1T, nothing wrong with that. It's a good vehicle overall. Just buy the base dual motor. It's like 600 horsepower anyway. It's more than enough. You don't need a quad. Just get the dual motor, and you'll get more range. It's still a very, very quick vehicle, even with that. So there's no reason to buy this one. Yeah. So the dual motor, the R1T dual, is rated at 0 to 60 in 3.4 seconds. You know, which is as fast as the quad with all terrain tires.
Yeah, which is still. I mean, where are you going to do that? And why, to be honest. You're going to impress. So here's how these things have always worked. You get the car, you go find somewhere in the middle of nowhere, hopefully, and you do the little like takeoff. And you're like, oh my gosh. Then you get a couple friends in there, you do it again. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Demo it a few times, and then you never do it again.
And then you never do it again.
Yeah.
And now you just, you paid all this money for nothing. You've paid like thousands upon thousands of dollars to go to Disneyland once.
Yeah.
Save the money, go to Disneyland a couple times. I mean,
You're paying an extra $35,000 to demo that a handful of times.
Which is an entirely other vehicle. You can just buy a Bolt, an Ioniq 5, a Slate, a Maverick. There's a lot of cars you can buy for $35,000.
So the R1T Quad, what was the other thing about this? Overall, it's not a bad truck. Oh, the other issue I had with it is just the R1s have an air spring suspension system. The R2s switch to a steel coil suspension system. I have never been terribly impressed with the ride quality on the R1s. After they did the refresh, it got slightly better, but it's still not very comfortable. It doesn't have much compliance. And for what is purportedly, supposed to be an off-road capable vehicle, when you're going off-road, you actually want the wheels to move around, to go over the rocks.
Articulate.
And stuff. Yes. And
I'm doing articulate hands right now for those in the audio podcast.
Yeah. So, with the air spring suspension, it can lift it up to 15 inches of ground clearance, but it doesn't, when you do that, you pretty much lose all your articulation. And even when you're at, lower ride height, at 9 or 10 inches, it still is pretty stiff riding compared to a lot of other trucks. So this is the ride quality, not great in this thing. But, it's got lots of, lots of cool storage. You got the gear tunnel, which is a neat feature. It will fit a rolled up stand-up inflatable paddleboard. So that will fit in the gear tunnel. They also offer the newer version of the camp kitchen now. I forget exactly what they call it now. They had, when they first launched it, they had this camp kitchen that basically took up the entire gear tunnel and slid out, and you had a couple of electric induction burners and a sink and storage for all your utensils and pots and pans. Now they have a smaller one. They dropped that. That was $5,000. They dropped that. They have a smaller one that just has the two induction burners and a prep surface for your food and some drawers for your utensils and stuff. That's a mere $1,400 now.
That's a lot less. $5,000 camping kitchen. They showed it to us like at some event. I'm like, cool. That's a lot of money when you could just get one of a thousand tiny little.
you can buy a nice, induction hot plate from Amazon for $100. Yeah. So you get a couple of those and get a box and some, something that, you can use as a prep surface for your food, for probably, $200. Yeah. And there is a built-in air compressor in the back. So there's a nipple there's got a hose there so you can air down your tires or air them up, when you're going off road or, inflate your stuff. That's all included in there. There is an actual spare tire in the back. So there's like a trunk area under the bed, and there's a real spare tire in there, which is very unusual in an EV. And got a good size frunk in the front. The only complaint I have about the frunk, is because the whole front surface of the truck is fixed in place. It's not like the F-150 or the Silverado, where the traditional grill area would go up, was attached to the hood and would go up, and you'd have a reasonable liftover height. You've got to lift stuff over the front edge of the truck to get it into the frunk. When it's down in its lowest ride height, it's not an unreasonable height, but it's, still something to consider. Yeah. Overall, if you want an R1T, You know, the one that I had came to a grand total of $123,885. You want to guess on the destination?
2,500?
1,895.
1,895. Oh, that's not too bad.
Yeah, it's reasonable compared to other trucks.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
Which but is I would
a lot.
Suggest
it's still like a lot, but still not too bad.
Yeah, if you want an R1T, just get the dual. You can get depending on which version you get between 533 and 665 horsepower, more than enough, and it starts at $80,000.
Yeah, it's less.
Yeah, it's not
so
cheap, but it's a lot more affordable, and it's very nearly as fast.
Yeah. You're not going to notice it. Yeah. You're probably not.
No.
Yeah. It's fine.
Three and a half seconds, 0 to 60. I mean, this one that the quad, because it was on the all terrain tires, it was only 3.7 seconds, 0 to 60. And so, depending on which tires you get, the dual is going to be, just as quick, if not slightly quicker. Yeah. You're not going to notice the difference. Plus, if you're not using, 1,000 horsepower all the time, you're not going to be shredding your tires so much. And, replacing tires gets very expensive.
Which is, again, it's just all these like super insane, especially on the EVs, because a lot of them are on like very, very heavy machines, which is without, and the stopping power. At some point, you're dealing with physics.
Yeah.
And these things they're off the ground. And they have a lower center of gravity because of the battery, but it's just a lot of weight, a lot of mass flying down the road. And what essentially should be mass or speed for a vehicle that's much lower to the ground, has better suspension, has better handling, has a better chassis, has better brakes, like those ceramic brakes on the M5. Those are amazing. You're not getting ceramic brakes on this.
No.
Weirdly faster than an M5 station wagon truck.
All right. Let's carry on here. So you went to New York on Monday, right?
I did. I went and I saw the biggest Audi, the big boy, the new 2027 Audi Q9. This is their three-row SUV. They finally jumped into that market. It's probably something they should have gotten into years ago, to be honest. Those giant three-row SUVs, people tend to like them. They keep buying them. They want all that space, whether they're picking people up from the airport or you have a family and you have, a lot of children or a lot of friends or whatever. So this is the largest, Audi. And so I went and looked at it, and it is, it is very big. It is very, it's available. They have the Q9, which is just the old regular one. And then they have the SQ9. So you have another vehicle. We're like, so you want a big three-row vehicle? How about we make it fast and sporty? Which is, that's kind of Audi's jam, to be honest, is to make things sporty. The Q9 has a 2.9-liter twin-turbo V6. It has, 429 horsepower, 440 pound-feet of torque. The SQ9 will have a 4-liter V8 with 591 horsepower, 590 pound-feet of torque. They're both cruising on the same 8-speed transmission. The Q9 will do 4.9 seconds, 0-60. The SQ9, 3.8. Sure. I don't know who wants to be in that vehicle when it's going that quickly. That's the...
And so, give your kids in the third row a thrill ride?
Yeah, I did get into the third row of this vehicle. The project manager's like, hey, you want to get into the third? I'm like, fine. And I got in, and across town, my knees are just, if the person in front of me moves their seat up, the second row moves their seat up, then you can, as a tall person, sit back there for short jaunts. It's two seats back there. You can go around town, hey, we're all going to dinner. let's just take one car. That's the situation. Mm-hmm. I always see those, that third row when it comes to adults. Hey, we're all going somewhere. Why don't we just take one vehicle so we only have to park one vehicle and we all stay together and we don't lose somebody because they don't know how map and navigations work. That's it. There's a lot of things about this that it has the MagSafe charging, which was really cool. I stuck my phone on it. It stuck to it. Which, you know, I didn't get to drive it. No one got to drive the car. They just unveiled it. But it looked, it felt as though there's just enough adhesion through the power of magnets that I think unless you're just driving like an absolute maniac, your phone's not going to go anywhere. So very big fan of that. There's like a little rail system in the cargo area on the sides where you can move these rails forward and backwards, and these little hooks flip out so you can stick your bags on there so your bags aren't like, you know, you put your bag, then you go around a corner and then all your cat food or your dog food goes spilling everywhere, which is what happens all the time.
That's nice. That's handy to have.
All those little cans that I have to buy every like week and a half. It's just, as soon as I go around any corner, everywhere in the back of the vehicle. I will say one of the sadder things that I found out is that it has the controls for the vents are in the screen.
Oh, howdy. Come on.
It was just like everything about it. I was like, all right, this, you know, I'm digging this for what it is. I think part of this job is there are vehicles that I wouldn't personally buy. There's a lot of vehicles I wouldn't personally buy, but I have to look at the market and the people who would buy this type of vehicle. And I think Audi's, I think they've hit a lot of really smart spots with this. There's a lot of very clever bits that I think people will enjoy. It has the automatic opening and closing doors. It is the first Audi that will have hands-free. It'll have a hands-free system like BMW, Mercedes, Rivian, on and on and on, this sort of hands-free level 2 plus system. So yes, it will have that. It's got a passenger screen, which again, I asked them, what's the passenger screen? Americans don't want it. They're like, yeah, it's mostly for Asia, which that's what every automaker is telling me the same thing when it comes to the passenger screen. But there is a passenger screen. You know, if you get tired of looking at your phone where all your friends live, you can look at the passenger screen. So cool, I guess.
You know, if you're doing a long road trip and you don't want to sit there holding your phone in front of you and you want to watch a movie or something, I guess, you know, you could do that.
Yeah, you don't want to hold your phone or your iPad or whatever. You can sit back, watch a movie. Stick your iPods on. And it also has the digital matrix LED lights. This is the first Audi that'll actually have the lights after NHTSA finally and the DOT finally said, sure, bring fancy lights to America. And so these are the lights that will, they're called light tunnel, or it'll mask out oncoming. So you can drive around with your high beams on without blinding anyone because the system with its 26,000 lights, I should have looked at my notes, a lot of little micro LEDs, it will mask out individual vehicles. So the sensor will see a vehicle either in front of you, you're behind someone, or oncoming vehicles, and it will mask them out. So those people will still see you in the light, but they won't get blasted with your high beams. Mm-hmm. So oncoming traffic, not getting blinded. The person in front of you, not being blinded. But you get to see the whole world with your lights.
I didn't get a chance to drive this R1 at night because it's still light out pretty late. But the last R1 S I drove actually had that. It was the R1's the first vehicle to have those in the US, or to at least to enable those. Audi's actually had these on their cars before, but they just 2011? Haven't been enabled in software.
They had the hardware on cars, and for years, right, you're like, as soon as NHTSA and the DOT say it's cool, we can just turn it on. Well, it turns out there's enough differences between the EU regulation and US regulation that they couldn't just turn it on, unfortunately. And part of that is that the light tunnels, the sort of the masking, has to be wider in the United States than it can be in Europe.
So you got to leave more of a gap around the other car?
So you have to have more of a gap. So they had like a plastic pig or something. They had a plastic thing that they stuck next to the car when they were sort of looking at it. And with the European regulations, they could see, you know, the light would hit that object that's next to the car without hitting the car. With the US regulations, it won't hit that object that's next to the to the vehicle. It's, you know, it's on one hand, I'm like, okay, that's sure. Why not? I mean, if it's one, if it's a little extra, less glare, that's fine, because for the most part, you're still going to be able to see everything, which is sort of the benefit of these lights. I'm very happy that, I believe it's 2022 that the, they finally, you know, figured out that people, these are better lights than what we have now. I think a lot of us have driven around in the United States at night and been blinded by, let's say, large pickup trucks, because we have a lower, our vehicle is lower. And so the lights are just shining right in your eyes. And you're just like, oh, great, this is wonderful. And they're not, they don't have their high beams on. They just, that's just their lights. So this is a, yeah, this is a very, to me, that's sort of the most exciting part about this vehicle. And that, you know, this will, you know, go through the entire Audi lineup as things get refreshed. Those vehicles will start getting these lights, or at least the option for these lights. I'm very excited to see them on, you know, the Audis, but also, you know, other vehicles, because there are too many people, again, with, you know, F-150, a Silverado, Ram 50. These, you know, if you drive anything that's not a giant SUV, you're always just like, oh, great, cool. Now I'm just blind for 15 miles while someone's behind me.
the downside of these lights, you know, I mean, they're great for lighting the road, but of course the downside is, if anything happens, they're insanely expensive to replace.
Yeah, that makes sense. So there, so you got that going for you. So don't run into anything with your lights. I mean, you have more light. You can see more, so you should not be running into things. And again, so, hands-free, keep your eye on the road. You're responsible, because if you hit something, you break those lights, you're going to have a pretty pretty expensive deal. I mean, you have insurance probably, but still.
I saw that the lights can also project the turn signals down onto the road surface.
Yes, that is an also cool thing that they showed up. I actually think this is kind of cool, because it'll project it onto the surface, both in the front and the back. So from the front of the vehicle and the rear of the vehicle, it projects like the flashers onto the road surface. So the sort of scenario they showed is, let's say you're behind a big box truck, or you're coming up to a big box truck. You can't see the vehicle in front of the big box truck. Well, that vehicle puts their blinkers on. You wouldn't be able to know what the intention of that driver was, because you can't see them, because they're in front of a big box truck. That maybe that big box truck is, you know,
riding
the left. So is it
projected out to the sides?
It projects it out to the sides.
Okay.
So project it. So you're driving up, and all of a sudden you see on the road, oh, someone's moving over into this lane. Now, whether or not, you know, they have the right of way, that's a whole other issue. But you know the intention of the driver that is in front of this vehicle. I think it's actually helpful for I think it could be helpful. Like, you know, blinkers, we all know, look for blinkers. But any additional, like, way of sharing the intention of what the driver's doing, especially when you're a pedestrian or a bicyclist, is cool in my book. I don't think it's annoying. I don't think it's going to create, like, confusion, because it's very much little chevrons that are just pointing in the direction the car is going to go. Of course, you know, the unintended consequences of new technology. We'll see how this works out in the real world. But for now, I think they showed this to me, oh gosh, years ago at the LA Auto Show. I had to be like at 2 a.m. or something ridiculous or something. I had to get up at 2, and I had to do something at 4 a.m. in order for them to show me how this system worked. I think it's clever, but I think it's also an additional little bit of information, and potentially a safety information that, you know, when you're driving, you see they're like, oh, this person's moving over. And, you know, if you end up sort of with tunnel vision, this is something that might break you out of that. Especially in California, where, you know, we're allowed the lane splits. Knowing the intention of the cars in front of you.
Would be very beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah, knowing the intention that you're like, oh, there's a car, you know, there's a vehicle that's going to get into this lane. Let me slow down and let them get, you know, move
now,
over.
Now we just have to teach Americans how to actually use a turn signal.
Yeah, so that's the unintended consequences of people don't use turn signals in this country. Use your turn signal. State your intention and then do the thing you're
you're supposed to do. That's the other, like when I, if I'm riding a motorcycle, like when people are doing things that I'm not, that they're not supposed to do, because it's always terrifying, because you don't know what that person is doing. And part of riding a motorcycle is being very defensive, and you end up learning very like the small little things that people do while they're driving, so you know what kind of driver they are. It's almost like a sixth sense. You can talk to other motorcyclists who ride a lot, especially in urban areas, or they sort of pick up on cues of how a person drive, like, oh, this person is going to pull out in front of me, and then they do, and it's because you're just sort of like learning how people drive and their little things that they do, and when you do something weird because you're like, oh, there's a motorcycle, don't do that. Do what's expected of you at all times.
Cool. All right, anything else on the Q9?
No, it starts at like $90,000 and then like $120,000. So it's not cheap.
It's not cheap, but you know, I mean, when you compare it against, you know, like a BMW X7 or a Mercedes GLS, you know, it's in the same ballpark.
Yeah, it's for what it is, that's the price you should expect to pay. Yeah, no, I think the sort of clever bits on it, besides the vents, I really like, because I know they're going to sort of permeate the rest of the lineup at some point. So those things I'm very excited about. Again, I think the most exciting part of this vehicle is the lights. I mean, for SAE, you know, writing it for a magazine, so it's not live yet. But, you know, my main thing is talking about the lights in my article. So
yeah.
It's just like, hey, these are cool, because we didn't have them before, and now we do. Because for years, it doesn't matter about the every automotive journalist has written a sort of a screed against the issue with lights like this. And finally, we have something, you know, with Audi and with Rivian, where they have these types of lights out in the world. So thumbs up to the automakers who are doing this and doing the work to make it a reality.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's carry on then. Also this week, Mercedes-Benz took the wraps off their next generation GLA, which is their compact crossover. So I think this is on the same platform, same architecture as the new CLA and the C-Class. So it means it's got, you know, the new Mercedes. It's available as an EV or as a hybrid. And so, you know, it's got the same EV architecture as the CLA, which should be very good. You know, all signs are that's an excellent system. The base version is a 48-volt mild hybrid. Where's the numbers? I can't see them. And then there's an electric version. Here we go. High tech electrified hybrid version. Gets 30 horsepower electric boost from the mild hybrid system. 1.3 kilowatt hour battery. Where's the electric one? Here we go. The electric one will offer up to 657 kilometers of WLTP range. So that's about 400 miles. So it should be well over 300 miles EPA range with this thing, which is pretty impressive, I think. 800 volt charging. I think the CLA will charge over 300 kilowatts, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, this one will do 320.
Yeah.
So, I've driven the CLA hybrid and the CLA EV. The EV is just better.
Yeah.
It's just better. It's just, you know, if you, as a person who drives and likes to drive and doesn't like things that stutter and like, just wants instant like gratification, the CLA is better. I'm assuming the GLA would be the same. You know, I drove an early version of the CLA hybrid. So we'll see how that
if they've tweaked that hybrid system, because I feel like there was some low end stuttering. It felt like turbo lag essentially for a hybrid system, which I'm not a fan of, to be honest, with especially for the amount of money and what this vehicle is, and the fact that it has a hybrid system means that it shouldn't have that. Yeah. And so, yeah, but then you get in the CLA electric vehicle and it's just like, boom, just cool, just wonderful. So it's going to be the same thing with the GLA, the same setup and everything. So just taller for America and everybody else.
And it looks like it's got, basically the same kind of interior layout with the available big hyperscreen, big splash all the way across the dashboard. Basically three displays in there for the instrument cluster, the infotainment, and then stuff for the passenger. But still has the nice round vents that you can just reach out there and grab, that's one of the things I've liked about Mercedes for a long time. So hopefully they keep those around.
They will keep. I have a review for the Maybach I just finished that's I can talk about now. Still has vents. You're like, oh, you can do it with the screen, but also you can do it with your hand. So why would you do it with the screen, to be honest? That M5 Touring, you don't actually touch the vents. There's like little controllers below it, that you move around. They're little hardware controllers that move the vents around. And yeah, I'm just like, oh, this boop, 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 boop. Again, I move the vents so much when I'm driving. Because I get in the car and it's hot and I just like blast it. And then my hands are cold. So now I have to move the vents away because now I want the ambient air to be cool, not just me. And if I have to do that with a screen, I'm just angry.
I know that feeling. I understand that feeling.
Yeah.
All right. So ran across an interesting story this week. Apparently, Shaquille O'Neal, he's somewhat tall. He's a little bit taller than you are. I think he's like 7'1", 7'2".
Just a scooch taller.
As someone that is that tall, he often has difficulty getting in and out of cars. And so when he decided to get a Lucid Air a couple of years ago, he had to have one custom built for him. He bought the Air and sent it to this shop had it converted into a two-door coupe. So they cut out the B-pillars, moved them back, crafted longer doors for it. Now that same car has been spotted on, I think on Copart. It was in a crash and it's the front end is kind of messed up. But just thought, might be worth sharing just a picture of what this, Lucid Air Coupe looked like. And actually looks like they did a pretty nice job on it.
It looks really cool. I mean, I like it. I mean, it's like a almost like a long, the 70s sedans where they have the coupes, and it's just like this really big door. What you need when you're 7'1", and it sucks. He spent all that money, he bought a new car, he had it customized, and then either he or someone he knows, or maybe someone took it. Anyway, someone ran it into something at great speed. I mean, the radiator's all,
And the thing only has like 2,898 miles on it.
That's a bummer.
Yeah. Oh, well.
And the battery's critically low.
Something else about Mercedes this week. Ola Källenius, the CEO of Mercedes, was speaking, and apparently, there's a bill that is going through Congress right now that was introduced by Bernie Moreno, senator from Ohio, and Alyssa Slotkin, senator from Michigan, neither of whom I am a fan of. The intention is to prevent any Chinese controlled manufacturers from doing business in the U.S., Chinese controlled automakers from doing business in the U.S. And in this bill, it says any company that's over 15% owned by a Chinese entity would be barred from doing business in the U.S., which poses problems for a number of manufacturers like Volvo and Mercedes-Benz, because Mercedes, 20% of Mercedes shares are owned by BAIC, Beijing Automotive Industries Company, and also Li Shufu, the founder and CEO of Geely. Between them, they each own about 10% of Mercedes, which would mean that as the bill is written right now, Mercedes, which has invested a lot of money in manufacturing in the U.S., builds most of its SUVs here, and you know, sells a lot of cars here, would not be able to do business here.
A lot of people.
Yes.
Like, they've been in Alabama for so long.
Yeah. That, and, since, you know, throwing, like, more than 30, almost 30 years, I think.
Yeah, they're going to invest $4 billion through 2030 for more to boost SUV production in about Alabama. I mean, it's just if you I've been to the facility, and it's huge, and there's a lot of jobs there. And, you know, those jobs aren't just Mercedes jobs. It's everything that grows up around that facility. So you have Mercedes, then you have any sort of suppliers that have decided, you know, it's best to be close to Mercedes because they're right there. If we should be right there. So you have that. And then all the businesses that grow up outside of that, you're like, oh, well, there's more people who live in this area. So now we're building our homes. Now we're getting, you know, now we have more stores. Now we have more shops. You know, we've raised the amount of money that people make in this area by, you know, X amount. And so now we can sell more expensive goods. There's all this is like this giant like effect. And then to say, well, if you, you know, and to be honest, like it, like picking on the automakers is so weird because so many things have Chinese investors, like, you know, and we're getting our phones from China and our computers come from China and this comes from China and that. And it's been like that for decades. And it's just very, this very weird, like, oh, wait, we have to worry about security. Well, we wouldn't have to worry again. We don't have to worry about security if we had proper privacy laws in this country. Yeah. I mean, China doesn't have to do anything. They can just buy it from a data broker like everyone else does. They don't have to like put in like secret back doors into your, you know, your Volvo or your BYD. They just go buy all that information from a data broker. Anything they want to know.
Yeah. So, you know, hopefully this bill will not pass because, I mean, it would be terrible. You know, as you said, you know, basically every direct auto industry job supports about seven other jobs in the surrounding economy, you know, between suppliers, you know, and all the other businesses in the region that, you know, benefit from the people being employed at the auto factories. So, you know, this would be a terrible thing, you know, if this forced BMW or Mercedes or Volvo, you know, or other companies that, you know, happen to have some Chinese investors, you know, to pull out. Yeah. Let's see. Let's talk about automated vehicles for a bit. Zoox, which is a company that was started about a decade ago, actually a little more than a decade ago, I think about 2015 or 14, and was acquired by Amazon in 2020. You know, I've talked about Zoox before. I've ridden in their robo-taxis. They're the first company to launch a purpose-built robo-taxi in the U.S. And it's an interesting looking vehicle. You know, it was designed specifically as a robo-taxi. So it is completely symmetrical. It has no front or back. You know, it has everything is the same at both ends of the vehicle. So there's a motor and suspension and brakes and steering system that's in a module at each end of the vehicle. So it's got full redundancy there. It's got carriage seating inside. It's got the same sensors at either end. And basically, depending on which direction it's moving, the lights just switch colors. So if it's moving in one, you know, whichever direction it's moving, the lights on that end of the vehicle go white. The lights on the other end of the vehicle go red. So, you know, it can turn around it can switch directions very easily. It's small enough to maneuver around urban areas. And when Zoox first announced this vehicle back in 2022, they claimed at the time that they were going to self-certify it. And, you know, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, their Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, has some, you know, they have a whole bunch of different regulations that cover all kinds of aspects of vehicles, including, you know, requirement to have a steering wheel and pedals and mirrors, things like that. Things that are not relevant to a purpose-built automated vehicle like this. And so NHTSA has a process in place. They call it a Part 555 exemption, where manufacturers can apply for a waiver that allows them to deploy up to 2,500 vehicles annually for 2 years that do not meet those FMVSS requirements. Previously, General Motors had applied for those exemptions on two different occasions. The first time, they had a version of the Chevy Bolt that Cruise was using that they built without any pedals or wheels or mirrors. And that, you know, before that exemption, before that waiver application got approved, they canceled that and switched over to the Cruise Origin, which was a purpose-built robotaxi. So they applied for a waiver for that one. And then stuff happened with Cruise, with one of their vehicles running over a pedestrian, dragging her along the street. Cruise got shut down before NHTSA got around to granting that waiver. You know, neither of those ever got granted. So far, the only company that has gotten one of these waivers was Nuro, who got one for their R2 delivery vehicle. Well, Nuro ended up deciding, yeah, we don't think the last mile delivery business is going to be a good business for automated driving, because, you know, you have the problem of somebody's got to be there at the end of the trip to get the stuff out of the vehicle. And, you know, their delivery vehicles were not designed to carry people at all. They were just designed to carry, like, groceries and stuff. And so even though they got a waiver, they never ended up building any significant number of those. They had a few dozen that they were using for development purposes. Zoox, when they announced their robotaxi, they said, yeah, you know, we're self-certifying. We, you know, we're in compliance with all of the relevant regulations. And they basically just said, these other regulations don't apply to our vehicle, so we're just not going to bother. We don't think we need to apply for a waiver because the rules aren't relevant to us. NHTSA started an investigation into that. Eventually, Zoox decided, yeah, we're going to go ahead and apply for a waiver. So this past week, they were granted a waiver. And the press release that was put out by NHTSA and then reported on by all kinds of media outlets said that, you know, that NHTSA was approving Zoox to run commercial robo-taxi operations with their vehicle now and carry paying passengers. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. NHTSA could approve the vehicle for use, but they have no authority over what the vehicle is used for, you know, whether it's used for carrying paying passengers or not. That's up to the states to grant permits for, you know, basically taxis and ride hailing, that sort of thing. So like in California, Zoox now has to go to the California Public Utilities Commission and says, okay, we've got a NHTSA approved vehicle. We've been testing our service. We want to run a commercial robo-taxi service. And then CPUC has to say, okay, you know, they have to look at the data and say, okay, we're going to give you a permit. And that's what they did with Waymo. They did that with Cruise previously. And they'll probably do that with Zoox. You know, and actually, Las Vegas, which is the first place they launched these things, will probably be the first place where they start charging for rides. That's expected to start next month. Previously, when I've been in Vegas and I've used Zoox, the rides have been free. There's no charge for the rides. So now they're going to start charging for rides. So, I think it's good that, you know, that they got the waiver so they can get 5,000 of these vehicles out on the roads over the next couple of years. And NHTSA also said that they're going to streamline the process for the waiver application to try and speed it up, because, you know, up until now, it's been taking like 2-3 years to get approvals. And the other big thing that NHTSA announced is that for the first time, they're actually going to start a process to develop performance standards for automated vehicles, which is something they should have done like a decade ago.
10 years ago? Yeah. Now they're just like, oh,
And they're going to be working with SAE on that.
Hey.
Yeah.
So, I know that place.
Yeah. So NHTSA is going to work with SAE to develop performance standards. Be interesting to see what they come up with, as far as what kind of standards they develop. It's about time, that's still a process that takes a long time.
It takes a while for a standard to get finalized.
Yeah, I mean, at best, it'll probably be at least a year before they have, a notice of proposed rulemaking. And then, once that gets finalized, it's generally a 3-year phase-in period. So we're probably not actually going to have any rules for these vehicles until at least 2030. But hey, at least it's a start.
We fast-tracked 3400, the NACS standard. And even that is just, every standard is essentially like a living, breathing thing. It's still, things are being adjusted, things are being added, and the way standards work is it's not just like SAE employees, it's like industry individuals. And typically there's people who are from, the research world, the education world, and there's people who are from the actual, like the business, from Zoox, from GM, from Mercedes, from whoever. And they all work together and there's usually someone who's in charge of all. There's one person at the top of all that who juggles that, who herds all the cats to make this work. And so it's not this is the rule. It's like, okay, it's all worked together to come up with now this part of the rule, now this part of the rule, now this part of the rule. And then you'll have like the standard will come out and then there'll be variations of the standard, like 3400.2, 0.1, where they're like, oh, now it does this, but also it does this and also it does this. So yeah, it's not a like, hey, let's just come up with a standard and let's bang it out on the weekend in a Holiday Inn in Detroit.
This is more complicated than a standard because, it's actually a regulatory process.
Yeah. So you have SAE plus the government. So both of these and SAE, the way the standards work, and like I said, with J3400 with NACS, that moved, relatively quickly for what it was. The US government took 10 years just to think of doing this. So I feel like what's gonna happen is SAE is gonna be moving and then they gotta like talk to NHTSA and then NHTSA's like, well, I don't know. I remember that.
Well, like with the
based
with the
on NHTSA's past, based on experience, historical experience dealing with NHTSA as a journalist, I feel like it's going to be, like you said, 2030 before this thing is.
Yeah,
is,
I mean those adaptive headlights. I mean they talked about that regulation for a decade or more.
Yeah, 2015 was when they did the tests where they said, "Oh, we can't have those," but they tested them within like a warehouse. Like I remember having to read how they did the tests, and one of the things is like, well, within the warehouse, the way the lights work, one motorcyclist had a glare, and I was just like, but you're not. That's not a. Why aren't you outside? Why aren't you like testing this within and there's M City, there's a place in Contra Costa County in California, there's places where you can do these tests out in the world at night with actual vehicles and actual, humans testing stuff versus like, oh, let's put it all inside of a big room and see what happens. I'm like, unfortunately, that's not how the real works. It's like whenever automakers or companies like, well, we've done 1 billion miles of training in a simulator. I'm like, well, that's good for you. I don't know what to tell you about that. I'm like, cool, I guess, but that's not the real world. That's not how the real world works. I'm like, yeah, we threw a bunch of scenarios. I'm like, no matter how many scenarios you come up with, it's never going to be enough to comply with what's happening within the real world, because every time there's a police officer or there's an emergency vehicle, and all these vehicles get confused. Clearly, all those simulations did nothing to help that.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing, most the simulations generally are testing the performance of the systems, the perception systems, the path planning, things like that. And then there's all these other things that happen in the real world. And like you said, emergency responders, a few weeks ago, NHTSA put out a call to all the companies developing automated driving systems, you know, to say, hey, you know, we want you to put together what you've got. We want to start talking about this. And I get the impression I get is that that is actually going to be part of these regulations, is standardizing how these vehicles interact with emergency responders, with police, firefighters, paramedics, you know, so that there is a standard procedure. You know, if the vehicle is, you know, coming up on an emergency situation and, you know, a firefighter or a police officer needs to redirect the vehicle, tell it to go somewhere else, there needs to be a standard procedure for a lot of these things. You know, and these are things that are not, you know, that they're not, they shouldn't be proprietary to any one company. There's no competitive advantage to that. That's a safety thing. That should be the same for everybody. The details of how, you know, the things underneath work. Yeah, that's, you know, that can be proprietary to individual companies. But beyond that, there's, you know, that stuff needs to be standardized.
I do enjoy that the image, the inline image within the article of the Zoox press release is a Zoox that apparently is running a red light. Like, it's, I'm assuming it's probably going to turn right, but its wheels haven't been turned. And if you look at the picture, there is a green light for the opposing traffic or traffic that would be running perpendicular to this vehicle. And it's been green for a while because the little hand is up and it's counting down to five.
Well, it may have just made a left turn. It may have been the later stages of a, you know, making a left turn from a two-way street onto a one-way street.
Maybe. All right. It just seems like that's not a, you could have picked another picture.
Yeah, true.
But yeah, it does look like it was making a left turn because the lights are white. So it's probably taking a left turn onto a one-way road.
Yeah, because
hopefully.
In this image, it's moving to the right of this image.
Yeah.
And because so it probably just made a left turn there. Hopefully.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed. Yeah. It's just like, don't put images that are sort of, wait, what's happening here? That shouldn't be a thing.
All right. Let's move on. So remember when Honda and Nissan briefly were planning to merge?
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And then Honda said, no, we don't think so. We don't think that's we don't need Nissan. We're in good shape. We don't need to be bringing in a company that's struggling. And then all of a sudden Honda started struggling and now they started talking again. And apparently they're now having discussions about how they can collaborate, you know, short of a full merger. And one of the things that they're apparently planning is to develop a next generation software platform for vehicles. And apparently from the various stories I've seen, it sounds like they're planning to do this based on Nissan's software platform that they've been working on rather than Honda's. Because Honda, for their Zero Series vehicles, their EVs, they had developed a whole new software platform for those. They had a new zonal electrical architecture, and they were going to have this Osimo software platform that was eventually going to make its way across the Honda lineup. Sounds like that's not what they're doing with Honda or with Nissan now.
We'll see. I mean, it's based on, is it according to people or is this a... According to sources, there we go. You got to get all the way down to the bottom. Informed sources. So who knows, to be honest, with Honda and Nissan and everything that's going on between those two companies and what's going on with each of those companies right now. But if it's one of those things where Osimo just wasn't working out, that could be like one of the other reasons why they decided just to kill their whole EV platform and just be like, you know what? Let's just take a beat and do what we do. And figure this out later.
I wonder if this would potentially also lead Honda to end up using the same new ADAS platform that Nissan's been working on with Wave using Wave software in future Honda vehicles.
It'll be interesting to see how the software stack, how that all plays out. Like who controls the bottom of the stack, who controls like that system and then everything that gets thrown on top of it and whether or not, you know, Will it be using, you know, like you said, like Nissan with Waves, or would Honda have its own system on top of that software stack? Yeah, the software is really, really hard. You can just ask, ask Volkswagen, ask Volvo.
Yeah.
Software is
General Motors, Ford.
General Motors, Ford. Almost everyone who's come out here with their, who has come out with their software defined vehicle, outside of like Mercedes, has had issues. And I think Mercedes is really smart, like setting up a shop in Silicon Valley, you know, decades ago, in order to make sure that they can get the talent that they need in order to do this software stuff. So, yeah, it's really hard. And if two companies have to work together to make it happen, it's better than one company going it alone and then coming out with something that everyone makes fun of for a year. And then after a year, it's just always tarnish their brand. Like Volkswagen will always be, you know, whenever I talk about software issues, what do I talk about? Volkswagen. Because it was just so bad when it came out.
Yeah. Let's see. Going back to China, Jim Farley, Ford had an employee town hall this week. And Farley apparently and other Ford executives also talked about that they do expect Chinese automakers to come into the U.S. market within the next 5 to 10 years. Despite the pushback from Congress, they fully expect to be competing with Chinese automakers within the next decade in the U.S. and in their home market, which would be interesting to see how that works out. I think it's going to be really tough for the domestic manufacturers to compete.
Yeah, I think how this is going to have to work is that China is going to have to build vehicles in this country. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the main way that they're going to be able to come into this country, which means they're going to have to deal with, first of all, they're going to have to deal with our homologation. They have to, they have to pay our, we have to give people jobs and pay them a real wage. Yeah. You have to deal with homologation. It's like when the dolphin or the seagull in China, it's like a nickel. But then when you put it in Mexico, it's like $23,000. It's like $10,000 more than what it is in China. That's because you have to like build that vehicle in this country.
Yeah, like a BYD seagull is like $21,000 in Mexico versus $10,000 in China.
Yeah. So whenever someone's like, oh, you can get a Chinese car for $5,000, like, no, you can't. Can't do that. That's not how this works. You have to like take into account that the fact that it's built China, it's, there's, whatever they're, and of course in China, like everyone does like 30 miles an hour if they're lucky, because if you're in a big city, you're not going very fast. Whereas the United States, we got big giant interstates and back roads and all these things. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. And I was looking at a thread of English, UK journalists talking about Chinese cars, because there are people who are like, oh, well, every Chinese car is just better than an American car. And for these UK journalists, are like, oh, not really. It's just that they're really cheap. They're inexpensive. Uh-huh. You can buy this one car for 30, or you can buy this one for 22. It's not as good as the $30,000 car. It's not like it's 22,000 and it's better than a $30,000
But they're not terrible
car.
Either.
Yeah, they're not terrible. They're good
they're
enough.
They're good enough.
They're going to do this. You can get around. You can do your thing. And when you don't have a lot of money because of inflation, because of weird tariffs, because of whatever, the Strait of Hormuz, whatever you're doing, you're going to get something that's good enough, because a car for a lot of people is just a utility. It is a hammer that gets you from your house to your work and your house to the store and your house to dropping off your kids. It's, uh-huh. A lot of people that they don't care that, that there's a wagon with, a V8 in it. I care. They don't. The average person just needs to get where they're going.
So it's going to be interesting times in this industry in the coming years. From China, BYD, they were at the Japan Mobility Show in October when I was over there. And one of the vehicles they had on their stand was a K car called the Rocco. It's now on sale in Japan for $13,000. It looks like most K cars, it's big tall, narrow box. You know, amazing packaging. And they've got two versions of it, the 200 and the 300. The base 200 is a 22.4 kilowatt hour battery and a range of 130 miles, $13,000. I think, you know, if Americans could buy a car like this for $13,000, they probably would.
I think, yeah. And then you can sing the Rocco's Modern Life. I know it's not spelled the same, but
yeah.
But it's like the Sakura, the Nissan.
It's a fantastic little car.
I love that. I drove it in Yokohama while I was in Japan last, and it was just wonderful because I was like, oh, there's enough space in here for all the things I need to do, but it's also a tiny car and it's an EV. It only has 111 miles of range. This has more.
Yeah.
And for this, it's like $2,000 more than this vehicle, but the 300 premium, the one that costs $15,000, the same as the Sakura, has 199 miles of range. So it has more range than the Nissan. I think people, there's going to be a lot of cross shopping and people being like, well, do I want more range or do I want my Nissan?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this does in the Japanese market. So this would be the first non-Japanese K car. Up till now, only Japanese manufacturers have bothered to make K cars because they essentially only sell in Japan. You know, they're created because of the very specific rules in Japan. You know, they've got if you buy anything larger than a K car in Japan, before you can get a license plate for it, you have to prove that you have somewhere to park it. And in a lot of Japanese cities, that's a problem.
Yeah.
But if you buy a K car, you're exempt from that regulation because it's so small, you can park it virtually anywhere.
They're just tiny and people just sort of put them in these tiny little, you know, these little spots in front of their apartment buildings, their houses or whatever.
The K cars are only 1,475 millimeters wide. It's about a meter and a half. So it's about 4.5 feet wide, which is very narrow. They're about seven and a half feet long. And the funniest thing ever, was seeing Bengt Halvorsen, who is 6'8", sitting in a K car in a Sakura, Nissan Sakura, and then, having the driver's seat set for his height and then climbing into the back and still having a ton of space behind himself, at 6'8".
The packaging is just, because it's just like, here's a box. That's all okay. You want a box? Here's a box. Here's a tiny box, but there's a lot of space because they're essentially squared. So you're not losing space because it's a coupe, or you're not losing space because here's your box. Go drive and do the things you need to do. You need to fill it full of whatever, hay, ramen, whatever you need to fill it full of. Yeah. You can do it because you're driving a box.
And, this one, the Rocco, the BYD Rocco, has sliding rear doors, basically makes it a tiny minivan. So perfect if you got young kids.
Yeah, no, whenever I look at the K trucks, I'm really looking at the K vans, because I'm like, I can put the dogs in the back, I can grab stuff, I can fill it full of stuff, and then I can just drive around at 25 miles an hour, not on the freeway, because you're definitely not freeway. Like I took the Sakura on the freeway. It's an electric vehicle, so it was fine. But they have essentially 600 cc, 680. There's a
yeah,
rule.
Yeah, for gas ones, they're limited to 660 cc's and 66 horsepower.
Yeah. So you're like, I'm going to get on the freeway. Maybe not.
Well, I mean, the speed limits on the freeways there are, I think, 110 kilometers an hour.
So like 65.
No, it's like 66 miles an hour, 67 miles an hour.
Yeah. So it's, you're fine. Yeah. You're fine. Yeah. They're.
All right. And then Walmart, there's been a couple of stories this week about Walmart how they are growing their EV charging network. And I talked a little bit about this when we talked about Operation Frodo, because there was a Walmart across the freeway from the hotel we were staying at in Omaha. And Nick and I took a couple of the cars over there to charge the morning before we left. Walmart currently, as of right now, they have 61 locations now with their own EV charging network. So Walmart got into EV charging back in 2018-19 when Electrify America was getting started. EA did a deal with Walmart and put a lot of their stations at Walmarts and Walmart parking lots. But now Walmart, you know, has decided to expand, you know, on its own. And Walmart has 5,000 stores in North America. And, you know, a lot of people go, you know, shop at Walmart, obviously. And so, you know, they are rapidly building out, you know, they opened their first ones just over a year ago. And they're building them pretty rapidly. That will really help availability of public charging, especially public DC charging. And one of the things they're doing is all of their chargers have both CCS and J3400 connectors on them. So you don't have to mess with adapters. You can just pull right up and plug in whichever cable you need. They're 400 kilowatt chargers. They're fast. When I was charging the Hyundai Ioniq 9 and the Kia EV9 at Walmart, you know, they were cranking along at over 240 kilowatts. And most of their chargers are the same. They're using two brands of chargers. One of them is the Alpatronic chargers, which are the same ones that are being used by Ayana. And actually, there's a new charging station that just opened up here in Ann Arbor recently that I just learned about, which is a BP Pulse station, which has 20 Alpatronic 400 kilowatt chargers there. And I was charging the Rivian there earlier. And they've got, I think 14 or 16 of the chargers have NACS cables on them, and the rest have CCS. So, these are really fast. The only problem I had with the BP Pulse charger was when I tried to use the app, I could not get it to start the charging session, but then I just tapped my phone on the card reader and boom, started right away.
Boom. There's a Walmart EV charging station 20.4 miles from my house. Of course, there are like dozens of, they are opening a second Tesla charging location within a quarter mile of the other Tesla charging location. That's like two blocks from my house. So there's one two blocks from my house and one about five or six blocks from my house that they're opening up. Cause I kept driving by cause they fenced off the area that PG&E was there doing something like, oh, they're putting a new charging station in. I wonder what it's going to be. And then, the other day I was driving by and they had the Tesla, little, you know, Tesla machines. I'm like, oh, well, it's another Tesla station.
Lovely Florida, which got $200 million from the federal NEVI program to put in DC fast chargers, decided, yeah, you know, we're going to spend that on infrastructure for eVTOL air taxis instead.
What? That doesn't make any sense. Unless somebody in the government's like cousin works for an eVTOL.
Probably. Yeah. You know, I mean, eVTOLs are interesting, and, you know, they will probably replace traditional helicopters in most of the civilian applications for those, you know, like in New York, you know, running over to JFK, you know, in an eVTOL instead of a traditional helicopter. But, these are never going to be a mainstream mode of transportation for most people.
Yeah, like how many times have you taken a helicopter to the airport that hasn't been part of like an automaker saying, hey, we're going to make you take a helicopter to something? Zero times. Yeah. Except for my friend who owns a helicopter and flew me around like LA. He didn't take me anywhere. He just gave me a cool tour. The average person, like, how many times are you going to get on a helicopter? I need to get on a helicopter in order to get downtown.
Yeah, like last year Genesis flew us from JFK into Midtown by helicopter for the New York Auto Show. And then like back in 2008 or something, Acura was doing a program for the TL out of New York. They had us stay in a hotel in Midtown and took us by helicopter. We flew around Manhattan and then up to Danbury, Connecticut to drive the car up there, and then flew back by helicopter back to Midtown, at the end of the day, and back to the hotel, and, drove back to the hotel. But I mean, the problem with these is, there's always going to be an inherent limit to places where these things can land because they are large. They are much larger than cars.
Yeah, they're pretty big. And also, it's not a thing that the regular person can benefit. No, a regular person doesn't benefit from an eVTOL.
Yeah.
I think eVTOLs are cool. They let me fly one of the, Joby let me fly their, their simulator. Cool. That's awesome. I talked to them about who uses it and how they get their license. Again, cool. You have multiple, redundancies versus a helicopter just has one thing. These have multiple things. Cool. But at the end of the day, people need to get places. And that's what this money is for, especially in rural areas where there might be a big gap in charging. If you're between, one big city and another big city in the middle of nowhere, hey, maybe we should use this money to put charging infrastructure in versus, supplementing rich people getting to the airport or getting downtown.
Yeah.
I think rich people are doing okay. I think they're all right. I don't think they need our help.
No. No, definitely not. And then last one I want to talk about is actually another thing that NHTSA is doing. Apparently, they are starting to work on regulations for door handles.
Yay!
Following what the Chinese did earlier this year, where they mandated mechanical door handles. Looks like NHTSA is going to do roughly the same thing.
Yay! No one should have an instruction. I shouldn't have to tell someone how to open a door. Ever. Yeah. That should never be a thing I should ever have to explain to anyone getting in my car.
The other night.
Or getting out of my car, especially.
My wife, getting out of the Rivian. She said, how do you open the door in this thing?
Exactly. That's not a thing we should have to explain to people.
Yeah.
Mechanical doors, they've been working for decades. Yeah. Let's settle down. Settle down. You're making things too expensive and too weird. And again, tech for the sake of tech.
Yeah.
Just open the door. Mechanical. Click. Open. Ta-da!
All right. Well, that's all we've got for this week. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And we will be back next time, hopefully with a third person joining us.
Woo!
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye.